If life goes according to plan, then today will be the last time we'll talk about James chapter 4, verses 1 through 10. And this will be the 10th Sunday we spent on these 10 verses. We spent 9 of the weeks looking at the spiritual side of conflict and conflict resolution. And the reason that I've done that with you is because that's the most important side. Today we're going to look at some practical steps that any of us can implement when dealing with other people in a conflict. And I hope that they'll be helpful for you. But these steps are only as good as your spiritual strength. In other words, the degree to which God is your source of security is the degree to which you'll remain faithful in using the steps, the ideas, the practical things we're going to talk about today. The degree to which God is the most valuable treasure in your life influences whether or not you'll use these steps as they're intended to be used. Loving your neighbor as yourself. And so there's this spiritual side to conflict resolution, even though we don't often make that connection. It is a very powerful connection. And I would urge you to keep that in mind because it's there and it is influential. Today I want to talk about the practical application of conflict resolution methods. I've given you a handout. We'll get to that handout. And I'll try to tell you when we're there. The backside, which is on apologies, will do absolutely last. So that's pretty easy. The front side we'll get to much sooner. Before we dig into this, let's pray together, and then we'll talk about this practical side of conflict resolution. Father God, you have given us your Spirit, you've given us wisdom, you've given us experience, you've given us learning, many of the tools we need to discover these practical methods for dealing with conflict. And it is my prayer today that these methods would honor you, and that we could see the connection between them and our own spiritual condition, our own right relationship with you, our own faith in you, our love for you, our commitment to your ways over our own way. Father, speak to us in this way today. I pray in Christ's name. Amen. Conflict itself invites us or forces us, it could be an invitation if you're willing to see it that way, but it invites us to live with others who hold different views, different realities, different expectations, different desires than we hold. And one of the first problems we face in resolving conflict is making the assumption that both parties, when I speak of parties today, I'm going to be speaking of both sides of the conflict. We use the word parties in Christian conciliation services because it was an easy way to identify two sides. Two sides could be one person on either side. It could be one person on one side, two or more on the other. It could be two or more on either side. So the word parties just covers it. So the word parties today is referring to both sides of the conflict. So one of the first problems we face in resolving conflict is assuming that both parties share the same reality. That means they see the situation just like you see it. They've had the same experience and same feelings about the conflict that you have. And they're looking for the same outcome that you're looking for. This is a good way to shoot yourself in the foot, is to make this kind of an assumption. And so to work through a conflict requires coming to the reality and ultimately accepting the reality that the parties probably have differing and even sometimes contrasting, competing stories, experiences, realities, expectations, and working all that out is what conflict resolution is about. For example, and for me, this has been helpful. It doesn't have to necessarily fit your experience or your life exactly, but you'll get the idea. I have tended to divide the world in half, even though I know this is impossible to do. And it's not a perfect fit, but it just helps me understand human nature. So I have aggressive people on one side and passive people on the other. And there's a lot of, you know, blending and bleeding back and forth. But just for the sake of giving an example, the aggressive or assertive people are more likely to see conflict as a difference in methods or goals. The aggressive person or the assertive person is simply looking at what are the methods we're using to get from A to B and what's the goal we have. And so when they don't see the methods or the goal lining up, they think that's what the conflict is primarily about. If you would just use the methods that I use, which, you know, I've liked my methods, they seem to work well for me, and if you would join in using my methods, we could resolve this. And if we shared the same goal, of course, we could resolve this. And so assertive or aggressive people tend to hold their story. And when I speak of story today, I'm speaking of what you would tell if you're going to explain your side of the conflict. That's your story. And when you're asking the other person to hear their story, you're wanting to find out how they see this conflict in as much detail as you can get out of them. And so the assertive or the aggressive person tends to hold their story as the accurate story. They've got the truth. Usually those of us who are take charge, we believe we're right. And so they press for agreement on a specific solution since they have the accurate story and they know what's going on and they know then what the solution ought to be or the goal they ought to head for. So they're pressing for an agreement on a specific solution with specific and easily measurable outcomes. Say it's a financial dispute. Well, we would just measure the outcome by how the finances work out. It's very simple. And if you would just agree with me, we could resolve this today and move on. One other example of the assertive person is when I married Barbie. I didn't know about all of this, but I soon discovered that my method of working through issues, I really enjoyed aggressive, even sometimes you might think it was angry. I didn't feel anger, and the people I did this with, to my knowledge, they didn't feel anger. But we would just kind of really go at each other to work out something, to work out a difference, whether it was a difference in how we viewed something or theology or principle or even a difference in living together. And we might shout at each other, call each other names, attack each other. But we were, you know, it was all in good faith trying to get from A to B. And the method worked for me. It was just a good method. Well, for Barbie, that was like terrible. It did not work at all. It was the total opposite. So here I am, you know, trying to introduce my method to her and thinking, of course, everybody uses this method. I mean, I was young and naive and stupid. Only to find out that it was totally counterproductive. Totally. She didn't like the anger, the shouting, the name-calling, or any of that. Sorry, that was offensive. It didn't seem like a good way to get from A to B. It seemed like the totally wrong way. Are you understand? All right, so passive persons, passive people, are more likely to see conflict as the other person's need to release tension or express frustration or to vent emotions or to solve a problem that's a problem for them. Passive people don't usually see conflict as themselves having part of the problem or doing something that contributes to the conflict. They basically see the other person as the person in need, and if they can just meet that need in the other person, everything will be fine. In fact, if the other person could acknowledge they didn't really have that need, everything would be fine sooner. That's more the passive person's approach. So the passive person is less likely to see the conflict as a result of something they're doing wrong. It's just that they're doing something that's unacceptable to the other person. It's not really wrong, it's just unacceptable to the other person. So the passive person sees the best solution as just kind of pulling back and waiting for the hostility to pass, for the aggressive person or assertive person to calm down, and for a few hours or a few days to go by, and everything will seem nice again, peaceful, okay. And then the passive person goes back to doing what they were doing, because they weren't really doing anything wrong. All right. It's rare. It is rare that both sides in a conflict share the same reality regarding that conflict. And if you go into a conflict believing that or demanding that, you've already missed the boat when it comes to resolving the conflict. Now, wherever you can find agreement, you should build on that, and you find agreement by getting each side to tell their story. You need to hear out what each side has to say about the situation. And one of the problems with storytelling is that our tendency is to listen in order to respond rather to understand. So when we listen in order to respond, what we're doing is we're listening for all of the key statements the other person is saying, which we need to correct or battle against or explain or something like that. We're not really listening to understand the other person's position, point of view, reality, story. So if you really want to understand where the other person is coming from in regard to this conflict, you have to listen to understand. My recommendation is, if you are listening and something is said that you want to go back and address, get a piece of paper and just jot a note down and set it aside and wait till the right time to go back and address it. Keep listening to understand the story. Don't listen to respond. Now, the other thing is, somebody has to go first when it comes time to tell the story. If you're the one to go second, don't tell your story in light of what the first person said. Tell your story in light of how you saw it. It's way too easy to hear what the first person says and then tell your story to kind of mesh with that or respond to that or correct that. No, the goal is to get the realities out on the table so that you can figure out where you're really at and what you need to do to take your next steps in resolving this. If you understand what I've just said, then hopefully you can begin to understand why the spiritual side of conflict resolution is so important. It takes humility, it takes patience, it takes trust that God will somehow work this out, even though there's two realities going on. It takes a willingness to believe that you could make progress with this if you're both willing. It takes spiritual strength get this far. All right, let's take a look at these two styles of behavior, assertiveness or aggressiveness and passiveness, in terms of conflict and go just a little bit further. The more assertive or aggressive a person, the more he prefers to be direct, specific, frank, calling white white and black black. The more he prefers to confront. And usually the more assertive person is more willing to disclose their own thinking, their own beliefs about themselves, where they're coming up short. And the primary goal of the assertive person then becomes dealing with the facts. I kind of told you this before, but they're more fact-based and trying to resolve the dispute quickly. Some disputes take a long time to resolve, by the way. The more passive or easygoing a person, the more he prefers indirect or ambiguous, what I call nebulous, cautious, non-confrontational, and subtle ways of working through the issues surrounding the conflict. The passive person doesn't want to say, "You're angry." Now, they may when they get really frustrated with you, but they like to avoid those kind of confrontational labels. They would rather say, "Well, you seem upset," or, but they're probably thinking, you know, this person's pretty angry. They just don't like to use that kind of language. So they're not as frank, they're not as confrontational, they're more cautious, more ambiguous in what they say. And so if you're more of the aggressive or assertive person, you have to listen to what the passive person is saying to try and figure out what they're really trying to get across. And this is where reflective listening is important, because you can reflect back what you think they're saying, and be careful when you're reflecting back that you don't simply offend the passive person by putting your words on what they're saying. You know, get close to that as you can, but reflect back and see if you're hearing what they're saying in a proper manner. Again, the passive person tends to see the more direct, assertive, confrontational method as threatening, unkind, unloving, relationship damaging, and probably a method that creates more problems than it solves. So it may be your fondest method, but if you're dealing with a passive person, it's not going to help you get very far. Assertive passive persons tend to view the indirect or passive method of dealing with conflict as vague, evasive, misleading, somewhat dishonest. And I say this graciously, basically useless when it comes to resolving conflict. All right. What I want to help us see is that we bring certain beliefs, certain personality traits, certain ideas, certain realities into conflict resolution. It's rare that both parties share the same reality. If you're a passive person, work at being honest and more direct. That will help the other party understand what you're really thinking, feeling, expecting. If you're the assertive, aggressive person, work at being more patient, more gracious. Take your time. Once again, if you're the aggressive person, you probably have the words right on the tip of your tongue that you want to say. So the other person says something, you've got a quick response. If you're the more passive person, it's real likely that you're going to want to think about it for a while. And so, you know, you could leave the other person kind of like in a 2 or 3 minute limbo, and in a conflict that can feel like 10 minutes. I know it's only 2 or 3 minutes. So you might say, you know, give me a couple moments to think about this and then I'll respond to that. Just let the other person know that you're thinking it through and you, before you're going to answer, so they know what's going on. Going to the first page of the handout, there's two sides. Again, not that life is perfectly separated in these two sides. But there's two sides here that I want to go through, and we'll look from side to side. The you messages, the I message, et cetera, down the page. And I want to just talk a little bit about each one of these so that you have some idea of why this is important. This is the conflict management styles. The column on the left is the column you want to avoid. The column on the right is the column you want to head towards. You messages. You messages are basically telling the other party what they've done wrong, why they're the cause of the problem. Now, eventually, that's got to happen if the other party can't see their part. But you don't resolve conflict by starting out telling the other party what they've done wrong. If you really want to work at the conflict, hear the story first. Start out by asking, you know, how do you see this situation? What do you think is going on between us? How do you feel about it? Get some information from them. The you message is simply starting out by saying, you're the problem, here's what you're doing wrong, and we need to fix that. The I message doesn't cut the corners on what the problem is, but it doesn't say directly, you're the problem. It says, here's how I'm experiencing the problem. This is how I feel about it. Here's how I see it. Now, in a way, it's just a simple twist of words, but for many people, hearing how you see the problem is different from telling them they are the problem. You may see them as the problem, and you can explain that using I messages. It still is easier for them to hear than simply hearing you're the problem. Now, it's my belief, and I think growing up in the world has helped me come to this belief, and being a Christian, it is my belief that we have a responsibility to both tell the truth, but also to tell it in a way that helps the other side hear the truth. So it is important to tell the truth, but it's also important to help them hear it. And I messages help that. The second line there is on communicating in generalities. When we communicate in generalities, we give the other party the opportunity to decide for themselves what we are saying. And they may not decide the same way you mean it. So generalities are not good. Too nebulous, and the other party is going to take it the way they want to take it. And most people, when you're in a conflict with them and you're too general, they'll perceive that things aren't as bad as you really believe they are. It's a rare person who could hear a general statement from you and translate it into the reality that you're pretty upset, pretty hurt, pretty bothered by what's going on. The greatest odds are is that they'll think, oh, it's not such a big deal. If you aren't specific, you are opening the door to making it easy for the other person to decide for themselves what you mean. So communicating in general or in generalities is not productive. Communicating specifics is productive. You can still be kind, gracious, loving, thoughtful, merciful, compassionate, all those good things, and communicate the truth in specific ways. Clearly. Third line. Talking about concerns with friends or associates who are sympathetic. We often do this just to kind of get a feel about where we should be in the conflict. You know, we got a problem, we're not ready to go to the other person, so we go to our friends. I think that's what the Bible teaches in Matthew chapter 15, isn't it? It says if your brother sins, you go to your friends and you talk with your friends about that person first? No, I don't think it says that. We are called by God, and this is really the best way to do it, to go to the person themselves. we only spread information about somebody that damages their reputation with people their reputation doesn't need to be damaged with when we just go to other people and talk about somebody. Now, if you need help and you need advice, that's another matter. Don't just go to your friends. Go to somebody who's equipped to give you that help, to give you that advice. Because they're not likely to think wrong things about the other party. They know better if they're equipped to give you advice. And they're not going to be spreading it to anybody else. And so we don't want to be talking about our concerns with our friends or associates. You don't need sympathy. You need to deal with the conflict. You need to deal with the matter. Go to the person themselves. If you need help or advice, go get the help and advice, and then go talk to the person. So talking directly is the godly way. Fourth one. Our words are friendly, but our gestures, our body posture, our facial expressions communicate something different. This is a tough thing to practice, but I urge you to just, you know, practice it. And that is having your body language, your face, your eyes, the way your body is positioned, saying the same things your words are saying. You can work at that. I get the opportunity to work at it because I do some counseling and people tell me all kinds of things. And I've been able to practice keeping the same face no matter what they say, regardless. So, you know, I have a place to practice that. You may not have the best place to practice it, but if you have kids, you know, they say all kinds of things. Right? So practice it around the dinner table or when the family's over. Just keeping that same not give away face when people say things around you that are explosive or whatever else. But we want to have the same message from our body as we have from our words. If our words say one thing but our body gestures say something else, the person that we're talking to is going to read the most negative of the messages. And you may not want to be communicating that. Number five. On the negative side, no apparent commitment to listening. You do most of the talking. There's no way you can resolve conflict by doing most of the talking. In fact, one way to think of your role in resolving a conflict is to see yourself first as an investigator. You're going out and getting information. If you can see yourself as an investigator, then you realize that you're not deciding anything yet. You're gathering information so that you can begin to decide. To do that, you have to listen. You have to hear the other person's story. And we ought to be asking the other party to tell us their story. It's always wise to let the other person go first. It's a good practice of humility, good practice of trusting God. And it's good practice at not responding to what the other person says by trying to correct it or fix it, but simply telling your story and working the process. So have a commitment to listening and being willing to hear the story in order to understand the person, not to respond to what they say. Not that their story may not need responses, but you want to understand them and their story first and then start working toward resolution. One of the good ways to listen is to use reflective listening. When the other party has given you some information, you might say, you know, can we just take a break for a moment? I want to see if I'm hearing what you're saying correctly. And you reflect it back. Not word for word, please, but the essence of what you've heard to make sure you're getting the right message, to make sure you're hearing what they're saying. All right, number six. You go at the solution part of the process speaking of yourself, stating your personal concerns and preferences as if that's what has to happen for you to gain resolution to the conflict. The other side of that is sharing what you would like to have happen, but not in a way that requires it or demands it, but in a way that puts that out on the table so the other side knows, while you are still committed to looking for a mutual solution. It's real probable that the other party is as imperfect as you are. And that means that they're probably going to have to give up a little bit to satisfy you, just like you're going to have to give up a little bit to satisfy them. So your idea of the best solution may indeed be the best solution if you're the only person involved. But because you're not, that's why it's a conflict. Because you're not, then you need to look for a solution that is good for both of you, is mutually beneficial. So it's okay to speak about what you would like to see. Don't demand it. Keep looking for a solution that is good for both parties. Number 7, being reactive instead of responsive. The reactive person is quick to attack, quick to defend their position, quick to judge negatively what the other person is saying rather than hearing it out just to see what the other person is really trying to get across, seeing the worst in what the other person is doing. Turn that part of your nature off. Be responsive to the truth. Listen longer. Sometimes it appears that what the person is doing is really totally wrong, and maybe it is in the end totally wrong, and there's no excuse for it, and we have to deal with that. Sometimes what appears to be wrong, we just need to get more information, and we see that they're not so evil-motived. Their thoughts, their way of looking at it, was their best effort, it just didn't turn out really well. That's different than being evil-motived. And so we want to be responsive. We want to listen longer to see why this person is doing what they're doing, what their beliefs were about it, what they valued, where they were going with it. You need to hear more of the story, hear other points of view. And in that, you're looking for a common reality. And the last thing on that list is a blame focus rather than a problem focus. It's real nice to place blame. I've concluded that one of the first things we do when we come out of the womb is we have to pick somebody that we can blame the rest of our life for our problems. Because you just have to have somebody to blame. Life isn't good if you don't have somebody to blame. So it's in our nature. But blaming doesn't get to resolution. Not unless you got a gun and they don't. Then, you know, you can blame all you want. The gun gives you the power. They have to agree or they're dead, right? But this isn't conflict resolution. That's tyranny. If we're going to resolve the conflict, blame is not going to get you anywhere. You can state how you see the other person's behavior. You can tell them the behavior's effect on you. All of that is right and good. But simply taking a blame focus is counterproductive. Look at the problem. We have a problem. One of the interesting things for me, and I had to learn this the hard way myself. I suspect others may have to learn it that way too. But those of us who are married and who just may have a conflict with our spouse, I know that may be rare with this group, but those of us who are married and may have a conflict with our spouse, you see, the reality is it's a problem that we share because we are married. We're one flesh. It's us. We share this problem. So blaming, you might as well blame yourself because you're part of this unit, this family. We're in this together. And so if we have a problem focus, we're more likely to get to a resolution that can actually solve things. Now, one of the lines that's not on this list, and this is a reality that If you've never faced it before, you're very fortunate, but you haven't probably grown as much as if you have faced it. And that is, not all conflicts are going to be resolved. Sometimes the other party just won't resolve it. So you can become bitter, angry, resentful. You can withdraw. You can do a number of things. Or you can accept that reality, make it clear to the other person how not resolving the conflict affects the relationship, and fight giving in to bitterness, anger, resentment, withdrawal, and continue to live a godly, loving life in relationship to that person. It's not always easy, but it is God's way. All right, four characteristics of productive or destructive conflict resolution. You don't have that on any of these lists. The first characteristic is each party is able to narrow the conflict in definition, focus, and the issue in dispute so that it can be clearly seen and understood. So that is a productive characteristic, being able to narrow the conflict in definition and focus an issue so that you can clearly see what the issue is and work from there. The other side of that, the counterproductive, the destructive other side of that, is expanding the issue. All right, now once again, paper and pencil. If you're going to sit down with somebody and resolve a conflict, one of the easiest things to do is to bring other issues into that conflict. Well, you also do this. And then there's that. All right, now we've got three issues on the table. Let's stick to one. Resolve one at a time. So you get paper and pencil out, and you think to yourself, those other two issues bother me, so we're going to have to come back to those. Jot them down. Sit the paper down and wait till another time to go after those. Single issue conflict resolution. So when you expand the number of issues, when you expand whatever, you are making it that much more difficult to resolve the conflict. Number two, the second of the four. Each party is able to limit the conflict at hand to the issues directly causing the conflict. In other words, they're not looking for secondary, third-party issues. They're looking directly at the issues that cause the conflict. One of the things that adds difficulty to conflict resolution is piling on. One of the ways we pile on is to bring in reinforcements. For example, everybody agrees with me. Or my mom, my sister, my cousin, Joe at work, Bill down at the garage, they all agree with me. What are we doing? We're expanding the conflict beyond the real issues. It doesn't matter if the whole world agrees with you. This is the problem. Let's address the problem. Don't expand it like that. So limit the conflict at hand to the issue directly causing the conflict and resist piling on. It becomes unmanageable if you do that. Number three, each party in a productive resolution process is able to direct the conflict toward a cooperative problem-solving resolution, reducing or minimizing or removing competition. This is not a competitive exercise. If you want a competitive exercise, play a game. Conflict resolution is not for competition. It's for working together to resolve the issue between both parties. And so you want to direct the conflict toward a cooperative problem-solving action. That's the productive side. The unproductive side is one or both parties resort to strategies of power or threat or coercion or even deception in order to win their side. Here again, this is the spiritual aspect of conflict resolution. If you are in it to win, you are not trusting God with the outcome, and you're not trusting God with your life. You may not win. You may have to live with disappointment the rest of your days. Do you trust God enough to do that? Can you find peace with God in the midst of that? Or do you have to win? One of the things that competition does when we bring competition into conflict resolution is it introduces an either-or win-lose mindset. You're no longer working together when it's either-or win-lose. You are working against each other. And once you start working against the other person, it's very likely, unless the other person is really solid in their faith in God, it's very likely they're going to respond in the same way. And now you've got a fight. There's no conflict resolution in a fight. It's win or lose. All right, the fourth one is, when necessary, each party is able to trust a third party. This is productive conflict resolution. If you can't resolve your conflict between you and the other party, you go and you look for a third party. And productive conflict resolution is when each party is able to trust a third party to help resolve the dispute in a mutually satisfactory manner. Destructive conflict resolution is refusing to use outside help, third-party help, in order to resolve the conflict. That's the destructive side. All right, some suggestions for increasing cooperation. How do we promote cooperation in conflict resolution? Number one, become more aware of your own personality traits and how that affects the other party. Going back to what I stated earlier between Barbie and I had to become aware of my own personality trait and how it affected the conflict resolution process. And it was a destructive effect. So we increase cooperation by becoming aware of that and then taking responsibility for your own behavior and personality traits so that you aren't introducing more problems into the process than need be. Second, place a high value on the good of the other. Are you in this to solve it your way, or are you in it to have a better relationship? You see, conflict resolution in the end is really about healthy, loving relationships. So when you place a high value on the good of the other, you are, in essence, placing a high value on the relationship. And by the way, if the other person's selfishness is obvious to you, you can believe that it is obvious to them as well. There'll be no doubt about that. Your selfishness will be obvious to them. All right, number three, don't fight over numbers. Don't fight over numbers. You did it 10 times. Noah, I only did it 8. And so we have a fight. For what? It's a very simple solution, in my opinion. Say you've done it too many times. You haven't done it enough. Leave the numbers out of it. That will increase cooperation. Do not fight over numbers. Number four, investigate. See yourself as an investigator first and foremost. Avoid the trap of thinking you know everything about the conflict. You don't. And to investigate, you have to listen. You have to ask questions. You have to clarify assumptions, your assumptions. You obviously have to get the other person's side of the story. And you should find out how your behavior affects them. How does your behavior affect the other side? That's part of investigating. Number 5, do your best to identify the real issue. You may think you know what the issue is. You may be close to what the issue is, but do what you can to identify the real issue. That's important in improving cooperation. There's always the stated issue, and there's the underlying interest. If you are, one of the problems in marriages is finances, right? So if you're in a conflict over money, you may think that the budget is the issue. It may not really be the issue. There may be an underlying interest in wanting to help the poor or certain neighbors that are in need or wanting to save for some future item. If that does not come out, then we can spend all this time on trying to agree on the budget, but we haven't really addressed the real issues. So you got to dig deeper. They call it going below the line. So we have above the line is what we usually say the problem is. If you dig a little deeper, you begin to find out what the real issues are, what the real concerns, interests, needs, and wants of the other person are. Number 6, discuss the long-term consequences. You want more better cooperation and problem solving? Together, look at the long-term consequences of going forward the way we are or going forward making some changes. Not what will happen immediately, but what will happen in 5 years. And remember, this is about relationship. Talk about how will this will affect our relationship in 5 years if we keep doing this. How will it affect our relationship in 10 years? What would happen if we changed? Look at the long-term consequences. Number 7. I think there's wisdom in agreeing on a method of verifying progress. If you resolve the conflict and you come to an agreement, you should write it down. But you should also set up a method for verifying progress over the next 3 to 6 months. And one way to do that is on a regular basis. More at first, less as you go. In other words, let's say you do this twice a month for the first month. Let's say you do it every week the first month, twice a month the second month, once the third month at the end, if you're going to do a 3-month plan. But you would sit down, look at each other, and say, here's how I think I'm doing in living up to our agreement. Here's how I think you're doing. And then the other person has the opportunity to do the same thing. Now, again, whoever goes second, it isn't your opportunity to blast the first person. This is an occasion to sit down and say, here's how I think I'm doing, here's how I think you're doing. We get the information, we compare it to the agreement. Are we making progress? Are we not? Maybe the agreement needs to be changed. Maybe one of us isn't willing to live up to it. But that begins to expose it. But at the same time, it encourages continuing to make progress. And that's important because you can make an agreement and 6 months later discover that one party didn't live up to it. And then you've got a bigger conflict. More trouble, more pain, more suffering. So work out a method for verifying progress. And the last one is agree on a method of dealing with failure. What happens if we fail? What happens if I quit living up to the agreement? What are we going to do? How are we going to handle that? This brings us to the last thing, and that's the handout on the other side. It's about an apology. I'm bringing this up because this is an important part of our own character. And our character has to do with how we deal with conflict. The first two columns are examples of apologies that you should run away from. If you like to give an appeasement apology, oh, I'm really sorry, I'm such a jerk, I always screw up, I never do anything right, I can understand why you're mad at me, I'm really sorry, please forgive me. Right? If that's your idea of an apology, it's not really an apology. All you're looking for is a little bit of sympathy, a little pat on the back, a little, oh, you're okay, I forgive you, everything's all right. So appeasements are not apologies. Second column is an account. You know, I wouldn't have done this if you weren't such a jerk. And I'm really sorry that I did it, so please forgive me. So, I mean, is that an apology? Absolutely not. It has nothing to do with an apology. It's a way of telling the other person they're a jerk and you're sorry that you responded to their jerkiness in such a manner that you have to say you're sorry. And you hope they'll forgive you. So, no accounts. Don't give any explanations for why you did what you did. Unless you want to say you're just an abject sinner. The third column is a true apology. It offers no defense, no excuses. It simply admits, I did it. And it was wrong. It shows true sorrow. I have no excuse. And I can believe this really hurt you. Right? It asks for forgiveness. It's not asking for sympathy. It's not asking for understanding. It's just asking for forgiveness. Would you please forgive me? And it's looking for restoration of the relationship. That's what an apology does. No explanation, no please feel sorry for me, just an apology. And when you apologize, address everyone that needs to hear it. Not necessarily all at once, you can go to them individually, but we need to address everyone that needs to hear it. Admit specifically what you did wrong. Here's what I did wrong, and I recognize it. I know it's wrong. Accept the consequences. To me, one of the premier examples in Scripture of a man who accepted the consequences is David. He may have sinned big, but he accepted the consequences for his behavior. No complaints against God. He dealt with it. Deal with your consequences. You did wrong. Something's going to happen. Sure, you're asking for forgiveness, but there's going to be some consequences. Accept that reality. Live with it. Make the best of it. All right. The practical side of conflict resolution is important. How you look, what you say, how you approach it. And there are wiser ways to do it than most of us grow up learning at home. So here's some suggestions for some wiser ways. Recommend you consider them, practice them, use them. Don't forget the practical methods won't take you all the way because you will abandon them. Where your faith in God stops and your reliance on self starts. So the spiritual side is essential for using the practical side to the end.